In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your coolest conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. My guest today is singer, songwriter, and producer of note, Butch Walker. Before he achieved fame working with artists like Taylor Swift, Pink, Weezer, Bowling for Soup, The Donnas, and others, he fronted the Atlanta, Georgia band Marvelous Three. They reunited this year and issued a new album titled Four that features our recent coolest song in the world, My Old School Metal Heart. We'll hear a portion of that now, and then I'll be back on the line with Butch Walker for your coolest conversations in Little Steven's Underground Garage, presented by Hard Rock. With you here in Little Steven's Underground Garage, and it's time for another Coolest Conversations. Joining me is singer, songwriter, musician, and noted record producer Butch Walker. This year, he and his fellow bandmates in Marvelous Three reformed and released a new album, their fourth, and it's titled Four, and it's home to this week's coolest song in the world, My Old School Metal Heart. How are you, Butch?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm very happy to be chatting with you today. You know, we did speak at least once before. It was several years back in 2016 around the release of Stay Gold. You've had a couple of albums since then, including last year's Butch Walker as Glenn, and now you're back with the Marvelous 3 album. I think this is the first since 2000's Ready, Sex, Go. I think of the band as like an Atlanta, Georgia-based group, but you and those guys, as I remember, had roots out here in Los Angeles. Can you remind us how the band began back in the late 90s?
Sure. I met Jace and Slug, the other guys, when I was 16, and I started playing in a band with them. We moved to Los Angeles the first time around in a band that would constitute as a hair metal band in 1988, I guess. And so we moved there, and then we moved back to Atlanta and spent the better part of 16 years in Atlanta myself after that. But the Marvelous Three formed in Atlanta, which was where we were starting to kind of come up and reinvent and reinvigorate ourselves as musicians and a sound and a style that was near and dear to our hearts as kids, which was power pop and garage and punkier rock and roll and also glam, you know. So it was kind of a little bit of all of those things all combined into one package that we called the Marvelous Three.
Well, why did you guys decide to take the hiatus?
Well, you know, there's this ugly side called the music business, right? And that was the side that started to really kill us. We had already put in let's say we'd already put in over a decade easy of touring about 200 shows a year. Even as a DIY band, before we even got signed again as the Marvelous Three, we had already been putting mega miles under our belt, and doing it all ourselves and schlepping it out in a van and making our own merch and making our own cassette tapes and CDs to sell at the shows just to get gas money to the next towns. And so when Marvelous 3 struck a little temporary pot of gold, we had like a, what people would say, a one hit wonder. We had a song called Freak of the Week that blew up on alternative radio, and it put us back in the hot seat, which was wonderful. And every minute of it was a justified, beautiful, archaic, you know, just mess of emotions and feelings and everything from having been through that cycle before 10 years ago, before that. Yeah. And so we definitely had this, like, we were having a lot of emotions about it and also mixed emotions about how we would be able to stay invigorated and energized touring, because now the demand from the label was so much higher. You know, it was like, careful what you wish for, right? So we signed up for this, ironically, with a song with a catchphrase in it called Tell Me I Sold Out. And so, like, we here we are playing late night, you know, with Conan, Letterman, Leno, and doing all the late night shows and doing all the festivals for, like, radio station festivals every day. And it was, the grind just got to be so hard for us that we loved it. But at the same time, the label wanted, they wanted more success out of us. We kind of wanted to start going about doing things our own way again. And really, at the risk of sounding cliche, we just burned out rather than faded away. We decided that we would end the band on a high note, because we had a good fan base and everything, but we were burnt out. We wanted to still love each other as band members, because we were best friends before anything. And the fact that we remain best friends to this day, I think is definitely a testament to how we went about it and leaving the game when we did, which is around 2001, I think, is when we finally called it a day. We played our last show in front of about 25,000 people at a free concert downtown in Atlanta, to our hometown crowd, and just went to the back of the bus and cried on each other's shoulders and said, man, it's been real. And we walked away, and we never saw each other on stage again for years.
Well, two things. One, when you did the last show there in Atlanta, were the fans aware that was
absolutely
it,
we talked about it. We talked it up, as we were like, look, this is it. You can't see us again. We're gone. And which is a lie now, but at the same time, back then, I mean, who would have known 23 years later we would do it again? But who would have known we'd be here 23 years later even?
Well, I think I wouldn't worry about that, because I've seen the Who say goodbye many times, and every time is really enjoyable.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I'm like, I don't mind them keep coming around and saying goodbye, because I'll keep waiting.
Yeah.
Well, then, so that leads us to, why did you decide to reform?
Well, so many reasons. One being, there was an obvious reason where the Hey album, which was the album that sort of put us on the map, that had the song Freak of the Week on it that blew up.
Yeah.
It turned 20 years old. And so it's 20th anniversary of, I think, no, oh, no, no, I'm sorry, 25th anniversary. It was our 25th anniversary of that record. And we wanted to go out and maybe do a show just to commemorate it and maybe see if we could re-release that record for the first time on vinyl. Because, you know, 98 was like that flux where there was no vinyl. You know, you couldn't manufacture it. All the plants were closed down. So that had already run its course. But it was also a very super boutique thing at the time. So record labels were not putting out their products on vinyl at the time. And so we never got to release it on vinyl. So we said, you know what, let's go do one show in Atlanta. And, you know, we'll play the big place, the Tabernacle, which is one of the last places we headlined, actually, in Atlanta as a band, before that festival we played on the Bricks downtown. And and we put it on sale, and it sold out in 30 minutes. And so we added a second night, and it sold out in 30 minutes. And then we added a third night, and it sold out in 30 minutes. And we were like, all right, well, this is real. We're gonna go out and do three nights in our hometown. Let's make it big and let's make it count. And so I think that really lit a fire under our asses, because we just didn't know that people really wanted to see it as bad as they did, and that there were that many people that would. And it was just a heartwarming, beautiful thing that all these fans never left. You know, they've been waiting for this, I guess, that moment. And so we ended up thinking it was a good time to do it. And also everybody's got their own lives. You know, the three of us, we all live in three different states. Nobody is like, no, you know, we all have very different, you know, demands for each person. So it's kind of like herding cats, you know, so we've got to like try to get all the cats in one room to make it happen. And we just made a concerted effort to do it. And we all literally got back on the treadmill and got in fighting weight for it and play the show.
Let me interrupt here for a second. I like the analogy to herding cats because you guys are also cool cats.
Yeah, man.
Okay. There you go. But so speak to a second here, because you mentioned you did the final show there on the Bricks, and afterwards you're in the tour bus, and you know, it's a really emotional moment. But you said you called it quits there to be able to maintain the friendship and the love that you had for each other. So that space in between there, the 20 something years, you were still, everybody's still talking to each other, hanging out on occasion, or
yes.
How did you maintain that relationship over those years?
Yeah, well, that's like I said earlier, the beauty of it is we never stopped being best friends. When we dissolved the band, we dissolved it because, you know, it would only ever be those three guys. We would never replace anybody and move on as that band, or reform as a band with other members. Like, you know, we just think that's bullshit anyway. We never really wanted to do that. So we stayed, I think, just having that trust in each other and having that commitment, it strengthened our friendship, I think, over the years. And also just the fact that we had put in so much together, man. We'd put in a lot of miles and a lot of heartache and a lot of drama on the road. As you know, like if you've been touring for 30 years, you've seen some shit. And especially when it's like 200 shows a year for a better part of that, there's no way you haven't seen some shit. And so we just really, you know, that stuff strengthened our bond as friends. And as age goes, and also when our parents start to go, which some already have, that brought us even closer together, because our dads were super close, and three of our dads are gone now, and they were, when we were a band, they were our biggest fans, you know. So yeah, we had like Don, Jack, and Butch, who were pretty much we were pretty much, you know, just, you know, younger versions of them, and so they were our biggest fans. And so I think when we lost our dads, you know, that bond made us grow even closer. And then just also every time I would play a show, for a Butch Walker show, pardon the third, you know, the use of the third person. But when I would do that in Atlanta, those guys would always come out. I would beg them to come out, and they would come out to the shows, and we'd get up on stage and do like a Freak of the Week or something like that for the fans, and people would go nuts. And that's pretty much when we knew, like, you know, no matter what, we're always going to have our friendship, and also we're always going to be good when we get back on stage with each other. So
you decided to reform the, you know, it's the anniversary of the previous release, that older release, and you have the shows lined up, reunion shows. So when did the light come on, the inspiration, like, well, we should do a new album?
Well, I think that was also, if we were going to do a show, reunion shows, and it turned into like a mini run, which it did, because we ended up adding two nights in Chicago to cover the Midwest the week after, we were like, you know, I don't like when people only put out reunion, you know, when they go on tour and then they don't have any new music, or if they do a new record and they just kind of phone it in and it's nothing that like people really want to hear. We actually were like, let's make a record that fans really want to hear and lean into the nostalgia and lean into the sound of the classic sound of our band, which was at that point considered a classic sound in the late 90s, I think. So we just said, look, I said, I've got some songs that I think would be great for Marvelous 3. I've got some ideas. Maybe we just get together in the studio and finish them out, and we put an EP out or whatever. You know, no expectations, really. And then we got together over a weekend, and by the end of the weekend, we had recorded the basic tracks to an entire record to 10 songs, and then the following week, I put the vocals on them, and then we had four, which and we're very stoked on it, and fans have, I think, by and large, really loved it because it feels faithful, you know, it feels faithful to the band. And it's super fun. We played a few of the songs live in the set, which you know how that goes, man. You go play your new songs, that's pee break time for the fans. but people went nuts and nobody left, at least that I could see. So it was awesome.
So let's think. So you recorded it. You were talking today. You're coming to us from your home studio outside of Nashville. Did you guys record those basic tracks at your place?
We did. We recorded it all here at my barn.
And these are the original bandmates. Do you say JC or Jace?
Oh, it's Jace. J-A-Y-C-E. Jace.
Okay. So Jace Fincher on the bass. Doug, I say, the Slug, Mitchell on the drums.
Yes.
And you mentioned you guys being through different states. What have those guys been doing since you guys began the hiatus?
Well, they've all still been dipping their toes in music. I think everybody ended up getting, just like I had my day job, which is mine went on to be producing and writing records for other artists, which I still do to this day and love. And it's a great day job. And they had day jobs that were also kind of based in music as well. I think Slug became a really successful drum teacher in mm-hmm. the Atlanta area, and also has his own business. He has his own landscaping business. And then Jace stayed active doing live sound production. And so everybody's, nobody just like checked out and, not that there's anything wrong with it, but became a real estate agent and or whatever, and completely eschewed music from their DNA. Everybody stayed steeped in music. And I think that's one reason why when we got back together, it didn't feel like we had to put on a costume for it,
Right.
And everybody just like got back in the saddle. And I mean, especially when we got here in the studio and all set up and played live and recorded the record, it just was like, it's like that, you've got this synergy and this chemistry and camaraderie and all these things that happen when guys have been playing together since they were 16 years old. It's just going to be there.
Well, here's something I want to work in. I want to talk about the tracks, some of the tracks on the album, especially the coolest song in the world. But first, I want to touch on this release I mentioned a moment ago that I guess it's from last year, Butch Walker as Glenn. It's kind of a concept album with you kind of being this persona, sort of piano man, piano bar kind of character. So number one, what inspired you to do an album like that?
Well, I think also I've got a lot of records under my name, that I've done, and a lot of them have been all kind of celebrating my influences and trying new facets of rock music over the years. And I'm so proud of all of them, and I love everything I've done. But it's easy to just, it's easy to start to get complacent with what you're doing, or think you have to do a certain thing in order to make a new album, or express your art. And I just sorry. And if that sounds pretentious, I'm sorry. It's just what it is. Yet as an artist, you get inside your head and imposter syndrome and all these things. And so I embraced the imposter syndrome on this one and became a completely different character, which is basically living through the piano and being sort of almost like a piano lounge, like rock club singer who's sort of maybe had his day or never had his day. And so a lot of the songs do lean on the more tragic side of lyrical content. But it was all inspired by, I got my mom's piano back that I gave her years ago before my dad died. I'd given her the first piano I'd ever bought with any of my mailbox money from making music. I bought a Yamaha Baby Grand piano. And I moved when I that's before we my family moved to LA. We moved out to California for a little while because of my work was keeping me out there. So I gave the piano to my mom. My mom loved it. She was, you know, she grew up playing piano. And then when my father passed and she wanted to move and downsize her house, she didn't have room for it. So she said, well, I want to give it back to you because I don't want to sell it. And I was like, well, oh, fair enough. So I got it back and I put it in my new studio here. And it just started conjuring up all these old memories of when I got it. I had recorded a record that was very piano heavy called Letters, which was a record I did back in like maybe 04 or 03. And it was just that piano just is sometimes there's a thing. There's an instrument becomes an extension of you. And when you get reunited with it, there's something there. And I wrote all of these songs for this record called Glenn, that it is what it ended up being. But it was all written on the piano, on that same piano. So,
Cool. Well, so if you guys, so the tenor of that, compared to this, the Marvelous 3 album, if the Marvelous 3 hadn't have reformed, would this the most current, the next album after you as Glenn, would that have been a rockin'? Would you have done a rock record?
I was thinking that's what you were going to say. I have no idea. And honestly, to me, the best rock band I've ever been in is the Marvelous 3. So why not just always make it the Marvelous 3 if I need to scratch that itch, right? And because, I mean, I had some of these songs laying around, and the reason why I never put them on my own records as a solo artist, so to speak, was because they would be doing a disservice to the Marvelous 3 because that's what they sounded like. Because I wrote the songs in the Marvelous 3, and so they inherently had that sound already, just without Jace and Slug on them. So I thought that I just thought that it would never be fair to put those songs out and me take that seriously without knowing that it should have been for a Marvelous 3 record. So I was excited about that we were going to do that again, because it gave me a great excuse to crank the guitar amps up and do solos and have a blast with volume and, you know, drums, because Slug is such a monster drummer and like not subtle. So it's like, when he plays, it's like a gorilla behind the drums, and you can't play quietly when that's happening. You have to deliver power. And so it was so fun to get to do that again. And I don't know that I would ever want to make another record that's that rock and roll under my own name, because I feel like I'm a songwriter. I'm a singer-songwriter now. And that's the identity I've settled into. And I'm happy there being one as well, but I'll always be happy to put back on, the guitar and plug it in to the Marshall and crank it up, but it'll just probably always be under a band name, if you know what I mean.
Well, let's talk about this coolest song in the world this week. It's My Old School Metal Heart off of 4. I'm guessing, you know, you talk about being out in LA with those guys and hair metal days. That, I mean, this relates pretty close to you and your bandmates' experiences, right?
Yeah, it does. I think it's loosely based on it. It's very loosely based on you know, the journey across country in your car, and also it's kind of I feel like it must be hearkening back to a relationship that you never could forget about, you know, your first crush or whatever, that you drive around listening to records with and listening to music to, and how all the bands you've listened to over the years have broken up and, you know, or stayed together. But it always brings you back to the memory of that person that you loved so deeply, and it helped shape your world at that time.
So when did you, you mentioned having, you know, these songs written already, whereabouts does this fit time-wise? Like, is this something?
Well, it spans.
15 years ago, or?
I say it spans, because in the first chorus, it talks about, what does it say? It says, we had the best of Maiden on cassette inside your car. So that kind of paints an era, right? When cassettes were in your car. And when you had a cassette player and you were listening to Maiden, which would have been sometime in the '80s. And then the second chorus, I think, says, "And we had the best of some new band on the iPod in your car." And that's
right,
pre-iPhone when it was iPod. So that would have been like around 2001, 2002, in a whole other era when you're listening to that music. And then by the end of the chorus, the last chorus at the end of the song, it says, "And we had the best of Slayer streaming in my beat up car," which streaming, obviously, here we are now in 2023. So it just gives, it's a couple of little catchphrases in the choruses that give you the, it's a timeline. So I think it's probably over the span of like 20 years or so, 25, 30, maybe even. So I like to think I wrote a lot of that based on my high school crush, that my girlfriend that was my first love, that took my virginity and was like, and also it also played in my band, was also the keyboard player in my band. And she taught me a lot about music as well. So I learned a lot about rock and roll, and you know, she was like 3 or 4 years older than me. So Artie was like, you know, more down the line with playing music and stuff like that. So I feel like maybe that song was spawned from that.
The other guys, did they have any, what was their reaction to My Old School Metal Heart?
I think they
I
think they all felt a kinship to it, because we all went through the same thing. We all went through that, like, just, let's call it a glory day, where you're, you know, you're in your teens and you don't have any adult cares in the world, and you're just really, really insatiable and wanting a connection, a physical connection, you know, with somebody else. And so I think when we first started playing music together was also around that time. So, mm-hmm. So I think it just brought back a lot of core memories for all of us, you know?
Yeah.
And so everybody was super on board when I played them the demo of that song.
Excellent. Well, who is the band pictured in the video?
That's us. That is
you guys. I was wondering if that was you.
I think so. I think that's, is it? It's all one band, right? Yeah. It's all one. Yes.
Yeah. It's all one band. And there's one couple of things with a guy, I guess one scene that's repeated is a guy, you know, smashing guitar on the stage.
Oh yeah. That would be me. Yeah.
Okay. So that's you. So that's, speak about hair metal. That is some hair in those.
Oh
days.
Yeah, man. We were hair farmers.
So the album's opener, oh yeah, My Old School Metal Heart is the album's opener. And then the next one, the way I'll read out the title is Kill a Mother That Breaks Your Heart. Do you know the best way to dispose of a body?
No, I can't speak from experience on that, but, you know, obviously it's a figure of speech, but it was another way of saying it's a more rock and roll way of saying I love you, and I will always, you know, stand up for you and fight for you.
Right. Well, one of my other favorite tracks on the album is the PTSD post-tour singer's depression. Mm-hmm. So what is your post-tour procedure for decompressing?
Man, it's so funny. Jace hit me up, and literally Jace hit me up like 2 days ago. We still text every day, but, he texted me, he goes, "Dude, PTSD is real." And because we had just come off such a high from playing these shows and people freaking out and losing their minds. And now we're back to working our day jobs, which is kind of what it's all about. Right. That's the cycle of life. And especially in the arts, there's always a come down. And I think it's never been perfected in my mind, even though I've been touring for, you know, ever. I've never really perfected the art of it, which is why that song exists, because it's a real thing of coming home and having to, like, you know, change light bulbs out that are blown and, you know, start, you know, getting up in the morning and taking your kid to school and get back on the horse when you were, staying up till 3 or 4 in the morning the week before on the road and, you know, having cocktails with friends and being in a different town every night. And it's like leaving the circus, you know, and coming home to a, but I don't want to say it's like, it's not like coming home to prison walls. That's not what that paints a really grim picture of what life is like at home. It's not that at all. You know, if anything, my family's very understanding of it because they've been very sensitive to it because they've seen it for years where I'll come home and it'll be like, you'll be restless. You can't sleep unless the room is moving, like a tour bus or a van or anything else. And you're just basically wondering what the fuck is going on with your life? You know, what are you doing? This is when a lot of the big questions start hitting you. It's like, what am I doing with my life? Am I doing the right thing? Is it okay that I'm leaving and going away and doing that and then coming home to this? And, you know, it can be heavy. And I know it has turned a lot of band members into alcoholics, a lot of people into drug addicts, because they can't take the come down. They can't take the boredom. If it's boring, that, you know, if they come home and they're bored with it, that's why you got to find an outlet, you know, besides if you have loved ones or a family. Some people don't come home to anyone. And I think that's really sad, but it is true. And some people are happy that way and that's okay. But, you know, in my case, I came home and channeled it into going in the studio and helping others make music. And it really distracts me from that part of the ego that needs to constantly be fed by being on a stage and being the center of fucking attention all the time and whatever. So there's definitely a buffer there. But, you know, I wrote that lyric about the struggle of like having to come back and face all those descriptive challenges, you know, of like, oh shoot, I've got to like, okay, let's go to the movies. I haven't gone to the movies in a minute. Let's go to the movies. You know, there's like all these little like, you know, normal like things that paint a picture in life.
Well, I'm glad that you've gone, you've described all that. I don't know if you're familiar, but I play in a band called The Woggles, was based nominally in Atlanta, began in Athens.
With Clay.
Well, no, Clay is in the Subsonics. Clay Reed. No, yeah, Clay Reed is in the Subsonics. But my band is the Woggles, and so we began in Athens, like in 87.
Yeah, I remember them.
And then still nominally based in Atlanta, but I live out here in Los Angeles. But that's exactly, you know, the way I deal with that is just going. It's the very same thing. Going straight back to work. I mean, you know. And that can be the focus and helps put that edge off of, you know, the sort of touring life. And then those other guys, you know, they have their own ways of dealing with that.
Right.
This, you mentioned having you did the several reunion shows and Jace was like texting you like, man, you know, still riding this high and now that's done. Are there any other touring plans for next year or any other shows before the end of the year?
We've not made any plans at all. And we kind of like it that way because we didn't want to get to a point where this was work. That's the big thing. We were like, we could have easily expanded it. And I think a lot of fans were disgruntled because they wanted us to turn it into a tour. And I don't think a lot of people realize how hard it is in 2023 to tour, especially when you're in your 50s and you've got families and jobs and everything else at home. It's just not that easy. It's not as easy as saying like, you know, come to Michigan, or, you know, or come to Iowa, you know, and it's like, well, as much as we would love to live the pipe dream of living on the road forever, playing 200 shows a year again, it's not a reality. And it's also not a reality for it to remain exciting and as fun as it is, and not a job when it is being done as a band reuniting. And that's what a reunion is. A reunion is to us not picking back up and just like continuing for indefinitely. It's a limited time offer. and that being said, it made it special because believe me, we burned out on it not being special the first time. So we didn't want that to happen again. So as much as we appreciate and love people wanting us to make it a thing and go on the road, it's just too expensive. And it's too, it would just start to feel like rehearsed and like work. And we did just enough shows where it did not feel like that. It felt special every night and we got goosebumps every night. And I don't want anybody to take that away from me.
Well, we can hear one more track off the album right now. It'll be Jackie and Tina. So Jackie was rock, Tina was roll. Any specific folks that this tune is based on?
No, but there has been a few over the years that have, you know, that have been fans that we've had close relationships with, some that have passed away, so it's sort of like an ode to those people. Cause we've age is a cruel beast and we've lost some people along the way. You know, we've lost some people to cancer and we've lost some people to heart disease, anything, you know, that is just, that comes along with, just growing and living long enough to tell about it. So, that is kind of an ode to the super fan, is what we like to call it.
And so you're addressing actually something I wanted to talk about, but that lyric is 35 years and it all goes black. That feeling for a friend never comes back. And I wanted to ask specifically who was your Tina, but you're speaking about in that song more to just the general people's super fans and a general loss that people undergo as life goes on.
You mean who is it specifically?
Yeah. Or do you have a specific Tina, a person, a feeling for a friend that never
sure.
came back?
Specific? I can say I do. Yeah. I can say I do. I can't, I wouldn't say who, but I can tell you I do.
Yeah. Well, another lyric in the song, I want to feel something instead of feeling old. And there is a theme to the album of getting older. That's being older. Touched on a number of the tracks. How are you doing with that? How old are you? Like 54?
I'm 54 as of like a week ago. And so.
Well, happy birthday.
Thank you. But like it's really just, I think I leaned into that hard on this because I felt like I would be talking to, I felt like I'd be speaking to all of the fans as well, because we weren't making a record for people that were 15 years old that listened to whatever 15 year olds listened to. We were making a record for fans. And these are fans grown with us and got the same gray hairs we do now. And that to us is, I think being honest in the lyrics about that kind of stuff and about dipping your toe in nostalgia, but at the same time, not forgetting that where you are now. And I feel like we made a good balance on the record of that. And that was important to me.
Well, Butch, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today on Our Coolest Conversations.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure, man. Thank you so much for all the continued support. And I just love the station so much.
We're going to take a listen now to Jackie and Tina. It's Marvelous 3 off the new album 4 here in Little Stevens Underground Garage. Some of their tune, Jackie and Tina. That was Marvelous 3 here in Little Stevens Underground Garage off their new album 4. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to the band's Butch Walker for being my guest today on Our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our segment. Tony Valentino, he was a guitarist in the seminal 60s band The Standells, played on all their tunes, including coming up with a signature riff for their moment of brilliance, Dirty Water. He's got a new album out now, titled Dirty Water Revisited,
We'll find out all about it next time around on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.